This is day five of this July 2016 7-day session. We'll return to our text from the last 2 days, a book called Zen Essence, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary, and it's a collection of short passages by a lot of different Chinese Zen masters. This is Zen Master Fen Yang, who lived in the 900s. I think the only little note about Fen Yang we have from the afterword is that he like so many Chinese monks, he had gone on many pilgrimages through China and meeting up with masters before becoming one himself. It says he had met more than 70 Zen masters. Someone asked Fen Yang, "What is the work of a teaching master?" Fen Yang replied, "Impersonally guiding those with affinity." Impersonally, because there is not subjective emotional involvement. There's not the self getting in the way. It's done cleanly. Impersonally guiding those with affinity. Such a rich word, affinity. I've come to appreciate it so much. We're drawn to teachers with whom we have a match, a good enough match. And the teacher doesn't have to be the best teacher. That's not the point. What really makes the teacher-student relationship work is if there is a rapport between them. Again, a good enough rapport. I remember being so astonished when we first got word of these terrible teachers who would act out so badly with drunkenness and getting sexually involved with their students. And I was just amazed that there were students who stayed with them. But I was naive, because if there is an affinity between teacher and student, then they will stay together. If there is a karmic affinity, and this affinity is not contingent on good behavior by the teacher. With some students, that would be a deal breaker, and that was a deal breaker with some students when their teachers kept doing this kind of stuff. They were out of there. But others, how do you explain it that they would stay? It's beyond reason. Affinity is beyond reason. You could say the same with marriage in many cases. Why do they stay together? Well, we just know. Not that it's much of an explanation, but we can be sure that they stay together. As long as they're together, it's because there's an affinity there. Affinity doesn't mean anything more than they need to learn something from one another, as in the case of teacher and student. They're not done learning something from one another. is another answer to a similar question about teaching. I forget who it was, teacher. May have been Roshi, but I think Roshi Kaplan was quoting another teacher who said, regarding his being a teacher, he said, I'm just sharing with others what I do seriously for myself. Because in Zen, it's not primarily a matter of instruction or telling the student what to do. It's working together. The Buddha once said, the strength of a spiritual teacher is his patience. If it is patience, it's not what most people think of as patience, because it's really faith. If you have faith in the student's bright, luminous, original nature, then it's not a matter of just sort of gritting your teeth and waiting patiently for the student to wake up, because you know the student already is enlightened. Here's another statement by this Zen master Fen Yang. The original Buddha nature of all living beings is like the bright moon in the sky. It is only because it is covered by floating clouds that it cannot appear. This is an age-old simile and a beautiful one. I think if you had to quibble with it, it's just that to think of the Buddha nature as limited to the moon is limited. There's a limit, putting a limitation on it. Well, what about what's around the moon? And this is why I prefer the sky. It's like the sky behind the clouds. It has no form to it, no figure or shape or limitation to it. And whereas the moon has phases, we see it in different phases, and the sky has this unchanging nature to it, this beginningless, endless quality to it. It's the Buddha nature of all living beings. Here's another one. When will you ever stop competing? Before you realize the scenery of spring has turned to autumn, the leaves fall, the geese migrate, the frost gradually grows colder. Clothed and shod, what more do you seek? I question this translation, competing. What makes more sense to me is grasping. When will you ever stop grasping after something that you imagine to be outside you? It makes more sense in relation to the last sentence. Clothed and with shoes, what more do you seek? Everything you need. One reason that I am a little more skeptical of Cleary's translations than other translators is because he turns out so many books. He translates so many books. One of my colleagues put it this way, his translations are quick and dirty. But in fairness, it has to be one of the hardest tasks in the world to translate from the original Chinese. It's such a elusive, imprecise language. Has no difference between singular and plural. It often leaves the is often without pronouns, so you don't know who is being referred to. And there are other things I'm sure that Chinese scholars could tell you that make it exceedingly difficult to translate. For example, the contemporary colloquialisms and local colloquialisms. Roshi Kaplow used to say the translator's job is a thankless one, because if it's a good translation, the author gets the credit. If it's a bad one, the translator gets the blame. Here's another one. When you know the mind, mind is Buddha. If you don't know it, it's the devil. Devil and Buddha are products of one mind. Buddha is real. The devil is madness. One of the most obvious ways to understand this is in terms of Makyo. We are now into the Makyo phase of Sesshin, where people are more likely to be experiencing hallucinations and strange states of mind and unusual physiological states. And the key thing, as I hope all of you know, is to recognize it. When this happens, when one is experiencing these things, to recognize it as a makyo. And which is another way of saying just recognizing that it's your own mind. If you don't recognize it as a passing state of mind, a side effect of zazen, then it can definitely bedevil you. That's the literal translation of makyo, bedeviling state. So, for example, the state of fear. This happens sometimes when we're getting deep into the mind in Sesshin, where we some kind of fear comes up. If we can recognize it, that it's just a passing state, which it is, no one is in a perpetual, unremitting state of fear. It's a passing state. If you can remember that when it's happening, then that will alleviate the negative reaction. The main thing is to take the attention off the effect, that is, in this case, the object of the fear, let's say. Don't get caught in the object, that thing or that one that is frightening, but turn around the attention and recognize that, oh, okay, this is a state of fear. It's mine. It's my own mind. one can play out all kinds of emotions at, let's say, if your practice is mu, at the mu or even the breath. You can get angry at mu. You can feel let down, disappointed by mu. This is just all one's own mind. These the impurities of the mind getting flushed out through deep zazen. There's this famous story, if you'll permit me to tell it again, where a samurai approached Hakuin, Zen Master Hakuin, and said, is there really a heaven and a hell? And Hakuin sized him up and said, you worthless loser. Where did you come from? And he just insults him all over the place. And the samurai reaches for his sword, takes hold of the handle, is about to draw it, and then Hakuin says, that is hell. And the samurai recognizes the master's point, and he bows to him, and he says, the master says, that is heaven. Few people believe their inherent mind is Buddha. Instead of Buddha, I think we still, most people maybe stumble over that word. They still see a Buddha figure associate it with the historical Buddha. Let's make it this. Few people believe their inherent mind is pure and luminous, whole and complete. Most will not take this seriously and therefore are cramped. They are wrapped up in illusions, cravings, resentments, and other afflictions, all because they love the cave of ignorance. They love the cave of ignorance. Here, we can understand this better if we think of ignorance as attachment to one's notions and ideas about things and oneself and others. That's ignorance. Attachment to one's conditioning, distorted views of things. And one way to understand that is this is a preference for what is known over what is unknown. We have all of these false ideas and concepts about the world, reality, people, things, truth. We have them so woven into us, so much so that usually we don't recognize half of them as having been acquired at some point. We think that the way we see reality is reality, but it's our interpretation of reality. And we'll choose that over what? What is there? What else is there? Well, the unknown. The darkness. There is a kind of perverse security in clinging to our ideas. And we can understand this as really a choice between thoughts, because that's really what ideas are. They're thoughts that have gotten embedded in the mind some way. Choosing between thoughts and whatever practice it is we're working on. let's say, mu. And as always, it comes down to a matter of faith. You have some thoughts in the mind, some design of some way that you're limiting reality. Is that where your faith is? Do you trust that? Or do you trust mu? Or let's make it the breath. When you have thoughts come into the mind, where is your principal faith? Is it in those thoughts? If so, then you'll linger in the thoughts. You'll chew on them for a while, maybe a long time. You'll insist on dwelling in your thoughts if that's where your faith is. And in fact, doing that pretty much suggests that that's where your principal faith is, in your thoughts. But if your faith is in the breath or mu, other questions, who am I, what is it, then that we could see as what is beyond thought. Each practice in Zen, breath, koan, so forth, each one, what they have in common is that they are all beyond thought. So what do you trust, your thoughts or what is beyond thought? Keep making this choice, moment after moment after moment. It's important to recognize that when you're choosing thoughts, well, that's what you're putting your money on, your thoughts. And that's sure to mess you up. Aldous Huxley said, "Most ignorance is visible ignorance. We don't know because we don't want to know." We don't dare venture beyond our knowledge, our so-called knowledge, our thoughts, into what is beyond them. This is where courage also comes in. If we're clinging to the known and familiar, that is, our thoughts, it takes some courage to step away, step beyond that. And what are we going to find beyond thoughts? Well, he offers something here in the next passage. "When you suddenly realize the source of mind, you open a box of jewels. Honorable on earth and in the heavens, you are aloof even from the joy of meditation," that is, attachment to states of joy. "The essence containing all flavors is the supreme delicacy, worth more than 10,000 ounces of pure gold." There are these metaphors that the masters use of jewels and gold and all. It can help appreciate these more if you can sort of rewind the mind to a state of childhood when the prospect of opening a treasure chest. It's glittering with gold doubloons and jewels and is just the most wonderful thing in the world to come upon such a treasure. That, he says, is what it is to realize the source of mind. "When you are deluded and full of doubt, even 1,000 books of sutras are still not enough. When you have realized understanding, even one word is already too much." Zen is communicated personally through mental recognition. It isn't handed on directly by written words. Well, this is the kind of hallmark of the Zen school, teaching beyond words without reliance on the sutras. Without reliance on the sutras. It doesn't mean that sutras and other texts don't have their place. It doesn't mean that Zen texts and Buddhist texts can't be an inspiration to keep you on the path. But it means we must not rely on words. They just point to the truth. One more from Fenyang. When you're settled in Zen, your mind is serene, unaffected by worldly distractions. You enter the realm of enlightenment and transcend the ordinary world, leaving the world while in the midst of society. Settled, when you're settled in Zen. Well, it's a wonderful phrase. When your practice has matured through years and years of sesshins and or daily practice, this is what we can discover, this serenity and centeredness, not pulled apart in even highly social situations, not stirred up by stressful situations. Roshi Kaplow once talked with a Japanese who had been involved in an earthquake, and he said that the couple, three people in the office who had Zen practice responded quite differently when the building started shaking. They maintained this calm, efficient movement. Didn't get hysterical, crying and carrying on. Most of us will never be tested that way. Most of us, hopefully none of us, will ever find ourselves on a plane as it's plummeting to earth. But imagine, just for a minute, imagine how will you manage that? As some people in the cabin are shrieking and screaming and throwing up and crying, and how will you respond? The longer we practice, the more likely it is that we will maintain this centeredness and this calm. And it matters in that such a situation, as we're dying, about to die, the condition of the mind as we're about to die. It's said in some Buddhist text that rebirth is determined by two things. The all of the actions of one's life as the basis. So you could say that our karma, our the way we have managed our behavior, our conduct, our thoughts, our words, all of that together is the basis and the final thought as the governing cause. The next master here is Shwe Do, Japanese, it's Secho. He compiled the Blue Cliff Record and inserted his own comments in many of the koans. His dates are 982 to 1052. Someone asked Shwe Do, "What is the living meaning of Zen?" Shwe Do said, "The mountains are high, the oceans are wide." He said, "When you illuminate your perception, your eyes are like a thousand suns, so that nothing can escape notice. Ordinarily, people just have never been so observant, but they should not give up in frustration because of underestimating themselves." This is an example of a translation that may be fairly close to the original, but isn't the smoothest in terms of understanding it. He goes from enlightened perception, your eyes are like a thousand suns, to then about noticing everything. Ordinarily, people just have never been so observant, but they should not give up in frustration because of underestimating themselves. How does the last part follow from the first? Well, let's make it follow. It's connected. If you find over and over again missteps of mindfulness, that is, missing things, being too self-absorbed to notice what you should be noticing around you, don't lose heart. And it's not only because of being self-absorbed that we can be unmindful, unaware of other people, what needs to be done, but it can be because we're too concentrated. This is a worthwhile distinction to make, is between concentration and mindfulness. Concentration can mean having tunnel vision. We're so concentrated on someone or something that we don't see around the periphery. We're not aware of what's outside that focus. The mindfulness is this broader awareness of other things. So sometimes when people are driving home after a 7-day sesshin, they should remember that if you're too focused on just the road right in front of you, this can be a bit dangerous. One of the principal instructions in good driving is to be aware of what's going on all around you, from the sides and from the rear and the rear view mirror, to be aware of all of this, and not just focused on what's in front of you. But it's so easily done after a 7-day sesshin that we're riveted on just what's in front of us. You see it also when people are talking right after a 7-day sesshin, where they can be so absorbed in the person who's talking that they don't notice that someone is trying to get by with a tray of cups or something. A mature Zen practice is to integrate these two, to have the ability to be completely absorbed in, when someone is talking, without distracting thoughts, and yet still to have this awareness of what's going on around you. Mindfulness, the one, mindfulness gets so much press these days as compared to concentration. But it's through concentration that we are more likely to awaken to the fundamental nature of mind. Having this kind of revolving awareness, we see what's happening around us and what's going on. This is important, something to develop. But it's concentration that penetrates the nature of mind, penetrates through discriminating consciousness to reveal what is beyond discrimination. He says, the wise boldly pick up a truth as soon as they hear it. Don't wait for a moment or you lose your head. The wise boldly pick up a truth as soon as they hear it. Why? Because it resonates with what they already know at some level. Actually, we all know. We all have this inherent wisdom. And some people, it's just more covered by delusions than other people. So when he says the wise, that is those for whom this inherent wisdom is more, let's say, to the surface, then they're more likely to recognize the truth when they hear it, see it, and pick it up, run with it. It's like what they hear is already an echo of what they know. But for all of us, it's just a matter of time before this eye of the Buddha that we all have in common opens. Someone asked Shui Do, what is your manner of teaching? Shui Do replied, when guests come, one should see them. When he says this, does he mean simply, when guests come, one should receive them? In other words, just simple responsiveness? The most natural kind of ordinary responsiveness. Guests come, you receive them. Or by see, does he mean see their true nature, see their who they really are? Don't know from what we're given here. Either would make sense in a way. Once there was a Zen elder who didn't talk to his group at all during a retreat. One of the group said, this way I've wasted the whole retreat. I don't expect the teacher to explain the Dharma, but it would be nice at least to hear the two words, absolute truth. The elder heard of this and said, don't be so quick to complain. There's not even a single word to say about absolute truth. Then when he had said this, he gnashed his teeth and said, it was pointless to even say that. In the next room was another elder who overheard this and said, a fine pot of soup befouled by two rat droppings. And then Shui Do comments, whose pot hasn't one or two droppings in it? We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind persons. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.